Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley traffic at this hour, a number of accidents for you to learn about. I-17 southbound at Northern, the left lane is blocked. Also, I-10 westbound at Central, the right lane is blocked. And there's also a collision on the 202 westbound at I-10. Valley weather for the rest of today, we should stay sunny, looking for a high temperature of 94. Then for tonight, clear skies, overnight lows in the mid to upper 60s. We'll start the weekend tomorrow with sunny skies and a high of 93. Currently clear and 91. Last year, the Centers for Disease Control added Mexico to its list of countries that have active Zika virus transmission. Most of the cases were in southern Mexico, but as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, as of last month, that changed.
The Arizona Department of Health learned there were a handful of locally acquired Zika cases in the Mexican state of Sonora, which is on the other side of the Arizona border. Jessica Rigler is with DHS.
There were some newspaper articles on it that came out about September 22nd or so, and we used that information to notify healthcare providers in the state that they should be aware of this if they're evaluating patients who have frequent travel across the border to Mexico, that maybe they should be suspecting Zika or considering testing.
Rigler says the outbreak in Sonora is fizzling out. She says there are now 42 confirmed cases of travel-related Zika in Arizona. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
On Wednesday, an Arizona woman named Michelle Bastian was booked on suspicion of terrorism after police say she mailed bomb-making instructions from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State to the prison where her husband is currently incarcerated. Court documents show Bastian's husband converted to Islam and had become radicalized. Mia Garcia is a spokeswoman for Attorney General Mark Brnovich. She says this will be the second time Brnovich will prosecute a state-level terror charge.
Arizona has a strict conspiracy to commit terrorism statute. It's against the law in Arizona to conspire with anyone to commit a terrorist act.
Bastian's arrest came 2 days after Brnovich announced Mahim Khan, the 18-year-old who was accused of plotting a terror attack at a motor vehicle office in Mesa, pleaded guilty to terrorism charges. He faces 7 to 14 years in prison. Again, AG spokeswoman Mia Garcia.
Our goal is to stop these homegrown terror plots before innocent lives are lost. And this is a new initiative by the FBI in our office. And these terror attacks are a huge threat in our community. And we are now moving to prosecute some of these cases in state court instead of federal court.
That kind of collaboration should become more common, according to Matt Mayer. He's a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and writes about issues surrounding homeland security. And Matt, you spent a lot of time thinking about the relationship between federal and state and local governments when it comes to counterterrorism and homeland security.
Yeah, I've been writing about the issue of federalism and homeland security now for about a decade, knowing that we can't defeat terrorism out of Washington or in a centralized fashion. It's a decentralized enemy, and we've got to be decentralized in order to defeat that enemy. So it really requires a partnership between the federal government and state and local governments as well.
In your mind, and maybe in a perfect world, what does that partnership look like?
So that partnership in a perfect world would look like sitting around a joint terrorism task force like they did in Arizona recently, where they look at what does the investigation and the intelligence tell us, what's the evidence that we have, and what are the legal authorities under the federal government, and what are the legal authorities in state and local government, and where is the best place for us to advance a case against a potential terrorist where we can secure the people at the same time as respect civil liberties and ultimately obtain a conviction.
Why do you think that approach is better than having the federal government sort of take charge of all of this stuff, but have local governments and local law enforcement sort of be their eyes and ears in local communities?
Well, because historically, if you look at America, it has always been the case that state and local law enforcement and the judicial processes in our states have been the primary criminal justice mechanism by which we've operated. It is only in the last 30 to 40 years where we have federalized lots and lots of laws, where we now have duplicative elements that the federal government does and so does the state. And in certain cases, the laws are different, which then allows us to, again, figure out which one is the strongest law for us to use, and then therefore we can use that and get the convictions that we need in order to make sure we keep people safe.
Do you think that in some ways the two cases, recent cases in Arizona dealing with terrorism charges, are instructive in this model?
I do, because it appears as if they did exactly what I had recommended would occur back in 2009 in my book, Homeland Security and Federalism, Protecting America from Outside the Beltway, where I talked about sitting within the Joint Terrorism Task Force and looking at everything in a true partnership fashion between all levels of government and deciding how best to proceed based upon what legal authorities you have, how the evidence could be used in various courts, whether it's a federal court or a state court, where it allows you then to get the greatest kind of bang for the buck in terms of your prosecutorial powers.
Do you find that local law enforcement and local prosecutors tend to have enough training in how to detect potential terrorists, especially some of these lone wolf type terrorists, and are the laws sufficient in states and in cities to prosecute these folks?
You bet. I mean, think about it. Big cities like Phoenix, Los Angeles, New York have been dealing with transnational gangs, criminal organizations like the mafia and other types of things, organized crime for decades. And so terrorism is just another extension of that. They have used surveillance capabilities, monitoring capabilities, undercover insertion capabilities for decades in those arenas. So having them apply it now in the terrorism context is really just an extension of what they've been doing.
Resources-wise, how do you find that states and big municipalities do as far as having what they need to go after these people?
Well, when it comes to terrorism, they're definitely under-budgeted because, you know, as you can imagine, you know, terrorism is not as frequent as murders, as assaults, as robberies. So those things are going to tend to get, you know, the dollars coming out of public safety.
Do you find that states and cities are going in the direction that Arizona seems to be, where we are starting to prosecute terrorism cases? I mean, are other states doing what you're hoping that they would do?
You know, Arizona really is on the forefront of this. I expect more of that will happen. Especially in this kind of ISIS Uberization era where, you know, the lone wolf, the small cell actors that aren't really directed but mostly enabled or inspired to act, that's going to require, I think, a greater partnership with local law enforcement than the federal government currently exhibits. So I expect to see a little bit more of that cooperation. And there are 104 joint terrorism task forces across the country, and that's where we'll see some of this work being done like happened in Arizona.
Matt Mayer is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Homeland Security and Federalism, Protecting America from Outside the Beltway.
FBI Director James Comey has said that voter registration sites in at least a dozen states, including Arizona, were targeted by hackers. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson has broached the idea of increasing the protection for the nation's voting systems. They could potentially be put under the umbrella of critical infrastructure, which currently includes the electrical grid and the banking system, among other things. Brian Nussbaum of the University at Albany recently wrote about voting and cybersecurity for Slate, and he's with me. Brian, what's in it for the hackers who go after voting systems?
So there are a couple of potential upsides from the perspective of a hacker. In some cases, it could be the information itself, although the information is not valuable in the same way that, for example, credit card information is valuable. The value tends to be more in the ability to compromise the perception of how the system functions. And so in that sense, it's not an economic upside like it would be in a traditional retail data breach. It's not even an espionage upside like you would see in something like the OPM breach. It's really the upside for the adversary is undermining the process.
I don't know whether these hacks are relatively easy if one is devoted to doing it or whether the challenge is there. But it feels like security is relatively lax. And if so, how did we get there?
So I think the way we got there is a function of we've taken this very important function in a democracy and we have not engaged in standardization. We've not made security requirements. We've not done a number of the things that if you were running an enterprise like a company or a government agency, you might do to try and ensure cybersecurity. Additionally, we've also pushed the responsibility for both creating and operating this infrastructure, this voting infrastructure, down to levels of government that in many cases are really ill-prepared and underfunded and understaffed to undertake them. And so what you have is you have this very, very important function that we use to select leaders at the national level that is largely run by the sort of cyber equivalent to your local Department of Public Works. And that's not to be dismissive of the local governments. They're doing very good work. They're trying very hard. They simply don't have the cybersecurity expertise and the funding required to secure big systems like this.
So is this something that is going to lead to a renewed commitment to this? Are we going to have local governments asking the federal government for more financial support, for example? Is this something that Congress could bring up?
You'll certainly hear discussions about that, and we've already started to hear some of that. There was a discussion in which Secretary Johnson from the Department of Homeland Security suggested that perhaps the electoral infrastructure could be treated as critical national infrastructure, which might bring with it certain funding and other sorts of federal technical support. There have already been state and local officials, however, who have sort of bridled at the idea that the federal government would play more of a role in this. And this goes back to a broader problem that we face a lot in a system of federalism, which is we have different levels of government that have different priorities and agendas. And for many of those levels of government, particularly at the state or local level, one of the priorities is to avoid the federal government playing too big a role in shaping how they operate.
Brian, how much of any big discussion like this at its root comes down to whether our leaders want to fund the process or not, whether we make an investment in this and whether we're ready to dole out money, almost like some people who decide they're not going to have insurance because why would I pay for something I don't need yet? But then when you need it, maybe you're not ready.
So I think that's exactly right. This is fundamentally at its base a risk decision. And whether you're a government agency, whether you're a jurisdiction trying to run voting, or whether you're a company trying to think about what your cybersecurity posture is going to look like, it's fundamentally a series of choices about how bad do we think the potential downsides are for if the bad thing happens, and how much money and staff time and other resources are we willing to invest in order to try and secure these things.
Brian Nussbaum of the University at Albany. He specializes in cybersecurity and terrorism.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. Let's look at the divided political world of 2016.
There are shifting ideas of morality and politics. The political morality we're used to seems to be playing a different role this year than in the past.
America is great because America is good.
There's Hillary Clinton. She's been using that line a lot lately. Her contrast to an opponent she wants voters to see as mean or ruthless, selfish, boorish, definitely immoral. Democrats might not be used to hearing their candidate try to grab the moral high ground in this way. Of course, Donald Trump has his own morality pitch. Hillary Clinton is a liar. Hillary Clinton is a lawbreaker.
And believe me, she has tremendous hate in her heart.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear from an evangelical leader on how Donald Trump has many traits you might not expect your average evangelical to like, but is still maintaining the support of a lot of Christian conservatives. But first, a different look at the shifting role of morality in American politics. Have things really changed all that much? Jeet here actually doesn't think so. He's senior editor at the New Republic, and he says that the more closely you look at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, the more you see that the politics of morality hasn't changed that much at all.
I think that political morality has to have an element of policy, or it's really about how we decide to live with each other. Any human community has to have rules, and we all have our own personal morality, but that's very different than political morality, which is the rules that we agree to live together. So I think that that's, for me, that's the simplest definition of morality, the rules that we come together so that we can exist as a community.
And so in that vein, Jeet, here, we seem maybe not for the first time, but certainly more loudly than in past elections, Democrats and Hillary Clinton in particular, using that very rhetoric of morality as the way we come together and live with each other, as a billboard at the top of the campaign. And we haven't really heard this so much from Democrats in the past.
I don't know if I'd agree with that. Like, I think especially Hillary Clinton, she and Bill Clinton, I mean, whatever we want to say about their personal life. I think we're talking about political morality. They've always been moralist. I mean, it seems ironic to say so, but Bill Clinton signed the Abstinence Education Act. There's a strong element of sort of morality of drug testing in the welfare reform. And the whole idea of it takes a village is a very moralistic idea. I think that the Democrats have always been, at least for the last 50 years, sort of have had this communitarian sense of morality.
It takes a village. We support one another. Things like that.
Yes. Yeah, so, I think those are all very moralistic statements.
So does it mean now that Democrats are filling a vacuum where there's communalistic, moralistic ideas have more volume because they think they're running against a candidate who is morally vacuous or mean or doesn't fit the moral profile of his own party and they just have an opportunity now?
Well, I would actually sort of step back and say that as perverse as this sounds, I think Donald Trump is a moralist. Because if we go say that morality is the rules that we live together, I actually think that he's articulating a very strong morality, which is sort of hyper-individualistic patriarchy. And I think that he both is articulating that morality and he lives by it.
So then we have to contrast that clearly right away with the type of morality and moralizing that we're used to in Republican politics, right? You're saying that Donald Trump is actually projecting a strong morality, but there's part of it that's in direct contrast with the moral politics of the right that we're used to. Donald Trump is new to being pro-life, of course. He's married three times. He's acknowledged lots of adultery and sexual behavior throughout his whole life in the media. So there's a contrasting morality there that he has to reconcile.
It's sort of. I mean, I actually, my take on Trump, which is a bit of a counterintuitive take, is that there's less new there than meets the eye. I mean, there are certain people, conservatives like Ross Douthat of the New York Times, who say, well, he's a sort of post-religious conservative. He's a playboy Republican. In light of recent events, we almost have to say he's a hustler Republican. But I think that that actually misses something very crucial, which is that there's a continuum in patriarchy. He is articulating a patriarchal vision. I think one thing to say about Donald Trump is that he doesn't bring something new, but he is unvarnished. He reveals what was already there, but sort of masked. He's offering patriarchy without the mask of chivalry. So I mean, the sort of, you know, the infamous statement, grab them by the female genitalia. As a friend of mine, Del Stan, says, you know, well, Republicans have always been trying to grab my genitalia. They've been, you know, trying to, like, have rules about abortion and whatnot. He's just, like, articulating that in the most brutal possible way.
So it seems to me, then, that maybe what Donald Trump is doing here, given that he is running at the top of the Republican ticket, is taking Christian nationalism, which has been at the center of Republican politics, and just shifting the emphasis more towards the nationalism, less from the Christian, but it's more or less the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's right. Although I'd even go a little bit further than that, because I mean, he always talks about Christian stuff, and he's actually called Hillary Clinton the devil more than once. And I think that there are actual followers of his, like Alex Jones, who actually do think that Hillary Clinton is a demon from hell, and has said that she like stinks of sulfur. So that's a moralistic vision. And the Christian conservatives are a huge part of his coalition. And there's some younger Christians, evangelicals, to give them credit, at Christianity Today and The World magazine, that have disavowed Trump. But if you look at it, like I think about 80% of white evangelical Christians are going to vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, this sort of libertine who mistreats women. And I think the only logical conclusion I can draw from that is that he actually does embody their values. And some of them justify this, Sean Hannity has, by saying, well, you know, King David had 500 concubines. So in a sense, Donald Trump is a biblical patriarch. He is that is the ideal of patriarchy, right? That you have one strong man who's the father of the family who can, you know, take as many women as he wants. So Donald Trump is old-fashioned religion in the classic sense.
The shifting politics of morality in America. Jeet here says, actually, they haven't shifted all that much at all. We're getting exactly what we've always gotten, just maybe a little bit easier to understand. Jeet Kheer, senior editor at The New Republic. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So some more now on this discussion of morality in election 2016. You just heard Jeet here of the New Republic. He thinks nothing has really changed, but you wouldn't know it listening to this.
Moral Majority is not a religious organization. The fact is that it's political. It's a very political organization, and one's membership is based upon citizenship in this country and a commitment to a pro-life, pro-traditional family, pro-moral, and pro-American position.
That's Jerry Falwell defining the Moral Majority way back in 1979. Ronald Reagan relied on the conservative religious coalition to win the Republican nomination in 1980 and, of course, the presidency.
Evangelicals helped the Republican Party win the House and Senate in the 90s, and George W. Bush, an evangelical himself, relied heavily on those faith-based voters to win his two terms. And there's no doubt evangelicals are still a key part of the Republican coalition.
But then there's 2016. Donald Trump, the three times married, very, very recently pro-life, money-accumulating real estate mogul from New York City, Republicans nominated him. And so that does lead to the evangelical question, does the GOP no longer care as much as it did what Christian conservatives think? Gabe Lyons is the director of Q Commons, a learning community that mobilizes Christians to think well and advance the good in society. And he joins me now to talk about the role of Christianity in this presidential election. Gabe Lyons, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
As you know, there's been a lot of criticism of evangelical leaders and some voters for getting behind and staying behind Donald Trump, not just for these recent Access Hollywood tapes, but going back to the beginning. You know, a three times married, admitted adulterer, long history of what Christians might consider less than moral behavior, pro-choice until very recently. There's been some criticism of evangelicals and Christians then getting behind a candidate like that.
Yeah, there has been, and it's very understandable because, you know, Donald Trump doesn't fit the profile of a typical candidate that Christians would rally behind. And I think it just goes to show how much our entire country is currently not satisfied with these candidates. And so certainly that's playing a role in how people of faith are also thinking. And some of the criticism that's coming at evangelical leaders, not only for voting for Trump, but I think it's coming because they're advocating for Trump. They're saying, this is what Christians should do. If you're being a faithful follower of Jesus, then you should put your vote here. And I think that's what's really putting a bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths.
What do you think has happened then in your camp with the evangelical leaders who, as you said, have not only said they're going to vote for Trump, but advocate for Trump?
Well, I would first want to just say there's a lot of evangelical leaders who are not supportive of Trump. But for those who are, I think there's a political calculation going on. They care deeply about religious freedom, deeply about pro-life. And they're essentially saying, I'm not sure I can trust Donald Trump, but he's at least talking a language that we understand, and maybe there's a chance he'll hold up these things, whereas we know 100% that Hillary Clinton will not. We know that she will nominate Supreme Court justices that don't stick to conservative principles the way most evangelicals would like to see the courts go. And so I think that's what's happening in the political calculation.
There's this political world almost, Gabe, swirling around the core beliefs that you're expressing about how morals should be reflected in politics. And right now there's this moment where really neither candidate is doing it. And I get back to my point before, which is it seems to me like evangelicals, whether they vote for one candidate, the other candidate, or none of the top candidates, get to sort of make political decisions like everybody else does. Sometimes we don't expect them to do that.
Well, no, I think they get to do that, but I think we should be very thoughtful about what our decisions cause. What are the consequences of a vote? It's not only to gain more numbers for a particular candidate, but it actually emphasizes and endorses certain behaviors. It says to the entire electorate, it says to our politicians, this kind of behavior is acceptable and we want more of it. And so I think we have to understand the consequences of our votes and also recognize as people of faith that we've got to do the hard work in our communities. That's why tomorrow night our Q Commons event, taking place in over 100 cities in the U.S., is actually convening these town hall meetings where people are coming together in order to address concerns of racism, talk about this election, go deeper and be thoughtful, not just sort of reactionary, but actually be a part of solving these problems by engaging one another, listening to one another, and even when they disagree, saying, let's find some common ground, because let's face it, on November 9th, that's going to be the moment where the hard work is going to begin for this country to start to heal and to try to bring itself back together.
That's Gabe Lyons. He's the creator of Q Commons, a learning community that mobilizes Christians. He was talking with The Takeaways' Todd Zwillick.
3 of Arizona's congressional districts rank in the top 50 nationally for the potential of younger voters to significantly influence the outcomes. The list comes from the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, also known as CIRCLE, at Tufts University in Boston. It includes Arizona's 1st District in northern and eastern Arizona, the 2nd District in southern Arizona, and the 9th District in Phoenix, Tempe, and other parts of the East Valley. Each includes one of the state's public universities. With me to explain the rankings is Kay Kawashima Ginsburg. She's CIRCLE's director. And Kay, what kinds of things were you looking for in these particular congressional districts?
When we looked at the historical data to see where young people really had an impact in the past couple presidential elections, we found that, there are three things that really mattered. First was really the amount of young people that lived in a district or state, so the population share of young people, and sometimes that was because of the college campuses that were in the area. Second is a turnout of young people, so the places where youth turnout is traditionally been good, there's been cases where young people have really affected the outcome of the election. And third is how young people in specific areas have really been different in the way they vote. In almost all these cases, young people vote overwhelmingly for a Democratic candidate over a Republican candidate in the district or in the state where older voters overwhelmingly support a Republican candidate.
I'm wondering if it can be challenging to use historical data because, you know, from year to year, the students themselves, and in some cases, the number of younger people in these places changes. I mean, sort of the nature of younger people is they're more mobile in many ways than older voters.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why we always say there's never a shoe-in vote from young people, whether it's for a Democratic candidate or in terms of turnout. That said, having a history of high youth turnout means that there's been potentially an impact by the on-the-ground outreach, or that the college campus has played a role as an institution in mobilizing young people by talking about election or really having a political culture where students regularly talk about politics and engagement. Those things all contribute to a history of voter turnout.
How do the results that you found jibe with what we keep hearing about how neither presidential candidate really is doing much in terms of successfully appealing to younger voters, and how a lot of younger voters are saying, you know, maybe I'm going to vote for a third party candidate, or maybe I'm just not going to vote at all?
That's so true. And this is why, you know, youth vote is impactful both in allowing a candidate to win or lose. So traditionally, like I said, these places where young people have had impact were places where young people showed an overwhelming support for, namely, President Obama in the past. In this case, it would be the vote for Hillary Clinton. If Hillary Clinton's campaign is unable to gain the momentum with young people, the votes that campaign may assume that they would have from these young voters either may not be cast, so that's their loss, or it may be cast for her opponent, Donald Trump, and that would spell trouble for the Democratic candidate.
And presumably that would also trickle down to some of these congressional races that you outlined.
Absolutely. So when there is, you know, for example, Arizona First, where there's a toss-up or tilt toward the Democratic direction race that's expected to be really close, those young people's votes are essential in the Democratic victory. So if they really fail to mobilize the young people who are living in the district and may not really know about the congressional candidate, it's a great time to really, really get to know them and really convince young people it's just as important to show up for the congressional district candidate as it is for the presidential candidate, whoever they're supporting.
Do you have a gut feeling as to what young voter turnout will be this November?
I try not to make predictions. But, you know, I think it's been really challenging to think about a really high, incredible turnout just based on the fact that young people are saying that they just cannot get excited about these two candidates. On the flip side, young people today, the millennials, really are the most diverse population that really cares about the sense of inclusivity and how globalized this country has become.
Kay Kawashima Ginsburg is director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, also known as CIRCLE, at Tufts University. Kay, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
In KJZZ News at 2:38, attention cigar connoisseurs, for the first time in 50 years, the U.S. government has lifted restrictions on the famed Cuban cigars and rum. Travelers to the Caribbean island can now bring home an unlimited amount as long as it's for personal consumption. Resale in the U.S. is still restricted. Previously, the Obama administration had set a $100 limit on what's brought back from Cuba. Jacob Johnson is a sales clerk at Churchill's Fine Cigars in Tempe.
They're great cigars. I'm not really too concerned about it cutting into our business because resale is still prohibited.
These cigars are limited to travelers, meaning you can't simply hop on a computer and order a couple straight to your house. Cigar fans actually have to make the trip to Cuba or any country that sells the tobacco product. The new rules go into effect on Monday.
The city of Phoenix has a diverse population and a lot of different choices for restaurants, music, and museums. But it doesn't seem to embrace other cultures in quite the same way that Tucson or parts of Texas are seen to. That's part of the premise of a recent piece Robert Paler wrote for Phoenix New Times. And he's with me now to explore where his thesis came from and whether there's any supporting evidence. Robert, how do you define whether Phoenix is disproportionately white in some way?
Well, I think what I was looking at in trying to refine my thesis for this piece was, if we are this close to the Mexican border, why is it so hard to find Hispanic culture here? With 30% of our population, according to last year's census, Hispanic, Mexican, American, Latino, Chicano, however you define brown, why don't we have a higher profile of that culture?
Is this a lack of knowledge or a lack of embracing the culture?
That's really something that I hope I brought to this story. I worried that it was a crackpot theory of my own until I started interviewing people who spoke to it very earnestly and honestly and said, that's it. That's a huge part of the problem, is that we come here from, for example, the Midwest, and perhaps we are more engaged in the culture of the place we came from than we are in the Sonoran culture where we now live. And man, I'm telling you, the hardest thing about that was writing this piece and researching it. For me, the conversation went from my fear that this was a crackpot theory of my own to the realization that it was absolutely true of me, the guy who was making the inquiry and writing the piece. Because I've always been more interested in my history in Ohio, where I haven't lived since 1963, than I am in my own backyard, where I have lived since 1963.
So what is wrong, if anything, with the way that people celebrate Dia de los Muertos or Cinco de Mayo, for example? Has that part of the culture been co-opted in such a way that does not lend itself to the real traditions behind them?
I would say no. And pretty much every Latino that I interviewed said yes. They said variations on, although it's great that these parties are happening more often and getting higher profiles and more attention, they are not enough, or they tend to be all we get. And it's hard to argue with people who've had their eyes on this because it speaks to their culture. Once those corporate-funded tents come down on May 6th, often we are not thinking about Hispanic culture beyond that date.
Is it better that we do it this way or we don't do it at all? I mean, does it seem worse to do it in such a way that seems cheesy, or to say, well, you know, we're marking it at least? Isn't that okay?
I think that it's important to do something. Certainly more important to do something rather than nothing. But again, the Latino people I interviewed for this story and to whom I've spoken since say, yeah, but it's not enough. Yes, it's not being done right. We're offended because it's sponsored by these big companies that don't contribute anything to our causes. I mean, it's a very enlightened thinking that I did not have when I began this inquiry.
So in order for Phoenix to be this growing metropolis it has been and wants to continue to be, and as Latino population grows, are we automatically going to see Latino culture grow, or are we going to see the old guard sort of steel themselves to sort of keep as much of the Anglo culture as they can?
No.
Are you optimistic about seeing a blend?
I am, but I don't think that anyone is trying to prevent Latino culture. I think that is not the equation that's at work here. And to answer your question, yes, we will see more Latino culture for a very specific and relatively simple reason, and that is that young people will be replacing that old guard who are maybe not certainly not preventing Latino culture from having a higher profile, but maybe aren't as interested in it. But the young people who are coming here with a different level of enlightenment. And quite frankly, the people who are in their 20s and 30s today grew up in a more liberal world, a more liberal Phoenix, if they grew up here, than I did. It's like any other formerly disenfranchised community. There is more potential for more empowerment in the 21st century.
Robert Pala of Phoenix New Times. We've been talking about his story titled, Why Does Phoenix Feel So White? We'll be following up with some of the people and groups he mentioned in upcoming editions of the show.
Submitting your best chocolate cake, sugar cookies, or pumpkin pie to be judged at a fair might seem like something from bygone days. But there are many people who are still passionate about these culinary competitions held every year at the Arizona State Fair. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to one Valley family trying for its first blue ribbon.
Four enthusiastic generations of Catherine Krause's family are gathered in her warm, cinnamon-scented kitchen in Mesa for a process they all admit sounds kind of gross. Krause is pummeling cooked apple pulp through a food mill. It's the beginning of something called apple butter.
It's not butter.
But a spread made of apples, cinnamon, sugar, and maybe some other secret spices. And at the Krause house, it's a fall tradition. A few years ago, Krause decided it was time to submit her apple butter to the Arizona State Fair. Why?
I'm from the Midwest. That's kind of what we do. We compete with food.
And she really does mean we. Her son and his wife are stirring the pot of bubbling apple butter. And Krause's daughter, Melissa, and her 6-year-old son, Logan, are using tongs to fish out canning jar lids from a pot of boiling water.
Oh, you got two. There we go.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Stuck.
It got
awesome.
Stuck.
I got it.
I want to win. Of course I want to win.
And they've got a fighting chance. This will be the family's fourth time entering the fair. Once they got nothing, but twice they came in second. Krause's mom, Sharon Hauser, says each time they make the apple butter here, over the course of 2 days, all together, while wearing homemade aprons passed down through the generations. This recipe comes from her mother, Grandma Margaret.
To do it as a family, that is the most important part to me. And my mother is looking down and smiling at all of us today.
This family story is one of many. This year, the Arizona State Fair got a total of nearly 500 entries across its various culinary competitions from all corners of the state. That's not as many as generations ago, but fair officials say they've seen new excitement about these contests, thanks to the popularity of cooking shows and foodie culture. A few days later, people are dropping off their creations at the fairground's cavernous Coliseum. Some are brand new to this.
My name is Kyle Avery. I'm 11 years old, and I made brownies for the state fair.
Others are old pros, like Karen Buckley, who goes all out.
Chocolate chip cookies, molasses cookies, peanut butter cookies, lemon bars, shortbread, macaroons.
Then there's Patricia L. Britton, who drove all the way from Payson to drop off her lemon-flavored fruitcake and German chocolate pecan pie.
Well, I'm a native, and I thought I'd better do it before I get too old.
It's her first time at the state fair, but L. Britton says she isn't nervous.
Because I enter the Payson Fair all the time and I win lots of ribbons.
As long tables start to fill up with goodies from Springerville, Mesa, and St. John's, Catherine Krause and her mom, Sharon Hauser, show up with two caramel-colored jars of apple butter.
Thank you.
No problem. Have a nice day.
You too.
Thank you.
We joke that leaving their apple butter here, it kind of feels like the first day of school.
It's like, take good care of it.
Handle it. I don't want to just hand it over to anybody.
Especially since this could be their year.
Yes. Win, win, win. Win.
We're just a little bit competitive.
The next day, I have to tell them they didn't win anything this time around. But they're not sad. Sharon Hauser says it's not like they lost. They had a good time making it. And next year, she says, they're going to enter a pie, too. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And the state fair runs through October 30th.
When you think of boarding schools, you might think of East Coast prep schools and uniforms. But one of the best-rated boarding schools in the country is right here in Arizona, and it's on a working cattle ranch.
The show's Lauren Gilger made the drive up north to the Orme School recently to find out more.
Drive about an hour north of Phoenix, turn left off of the I-17 at Orme Road, and the pavement turns to dirt pretty quickly. A few miles further, and you'll see a wooden post with four sticks hanging from it in the shape of a cattle brand.
Quarter Circle V-Bar. That's the brand that they brand on the cows, so it kind of just became the school symbol, too.
Sheila June is a junior at the Orme School, a boarding school built on the Orme family ranch in central Arizona in 1929 that's still a working cattle ranch today. Over lunch in a crowded hall on campus, she says her parents weren't so sure about sending her there at first.
You blink and you miss it kind of thing. It's like in the middle of the desert, and I'm sending my kid off here. Like, oh my gosh.
June transferred to the high school last year from a large Catholic high school in Los Angeles. Orme currently has 110 students total.
I just wanted something different, you know?
Different may be an understatement.
We have intro to horsemanship this year and I think colt breaking class.
There's gardening, horsemanship, swimming, robotics. The 3D art program was probably one of my biggest selling points.
That's Remington, Remy, Finney, and Elijah Smythe, more upperclassmen at Orme. They tell me there's also glass blowing here and blacksmithing, sustainability class, and of course, cattle branding in the spring. And just a third of the students at the school are from Arizona.
My roommate last year was from Italy. I have a roommate today from Vietnam. I know people from Ethiopia, Germany, all over the U.S.
They come from nearly a dozen states and nearly 30 countries.
Tuition at the school runs as much as many private universities at $46,000 a year. But according to headmaster Bruce Sanborn, students come here from all kinds of backgrounds.
We have people from totally different walks of life, some from urban settings and some from rural settings, some from significant wealth, some from hardly a dime in their pocket. And all those kinds of dynamics allow for a significant amount of growth.
At least half of their students from Arizona are on some kind of need-based scholarship, and they have a scholarship fund specifically for students from Arizona. Sanborn says some of the students end up at Orme because their local schools weren't challenging them enough, or
they're attending a pretty strong school, but they're kind of falling through the cracks.
So I was like a C average student, which was like terrible to say, and I'm so like ashamed of saying that.
At her old school, Finney says she wasn't doing as well as she knew she could, but now she's an honor student.
I'm applying to UC Boulder, Michigan State, Oregon State, and I actually just got enrolled into NAU. I got my first college acceptance yesterday.
With cicadas buzzing around us, we walk past the original schoolhouse where the Orme family taught their children and their ranch hands' children, past the library, the non-religious chapel, past classrooms and dorms.
Up bio is the girls' dorms, and down bio, it's basically just like a really nice, cool hangout spot for all the girls.
We walk past faculty houses. They all live on campus with the students. We check out the glassblowing studio. We walk into the student commons and past the orchard they planted 2 years ago, and we stop to eat tiny strawberries growing in the campus garden.
I could just live off of this.
These students say it was harder for their parents to send them to boarding school than it was for them to leave home at 15 or 16 years old. They say they've been independent their whole lives.
This is actually the road that goes to up top.
Up top, that's what you call where the horses are?
Yes.
It seems like there's a little bit of another language here.
In just a few hours, they mention Founders, Vespers, Graduation Lawn, AODs and Prefects, Up Bio and Down Bio, Girls Camp and Boys Camp.
All of the dorm names.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all the dorm names. Like McClure, Kettlebell, Up Flower Pot, Down Flower Pot, Butterfly. Keating, Butterfly, Ball.
It feels like a tight-knit community, off in its own little world on the ranch with the cicadas buzzing. But even out here, there are reminders that these are still modern-day teenagers.
What about, cell phones and stuff? You guys have those on campus?
We do.
Service?
Yes.
The whole school has Wi-Fi.
We have Wi-Fi, but you get the best service up top. You actually get LTE.
True.
You get LTE up top, and it's the best thing ever.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
Hey, Mark, congratulations. You almost made the weekend, buddy. Give me a high five.
Bring it up.
High five.
Give me five.
High five!
Up high! Down low!
High five!
High five!
High five!
High fives, fist bumps, and handshakes can all be ways to acknowledge a friend or colleague's job well done, or can simply be used as a friendly greeting. But do they actually improve how we work together or relate to each other? The Phoenix Suns under head coach Earl Watson are becoming the first professional sports team to keep track of high fives, fist bumps, and the like as part of a theory that winning teams do more of all those things. And Yale assistant professor Michael Krauss actually looked into the topic with colleagues. They focused on NBA players, and their conclusions were released in 2010, and Michael Krauss is with me now. Michael, I kind of wish we could high-five right now to get the conversation off to a good start, but failing that, what did you and your colleagues determine from the research?
What we found was teams that touched more in that single game early on tended to perform better over the course of the entire season, and we controlled for a number of other factors about the team salaries, individual player status, preseason expectations, and that association between touch, which we think indicates the cooperation inherent in these teams, still predicted performance.
So when you heard about the Phoenix Suns and their head coach Earl Watson wanting to keep track of things like high fives and fist bumps, what did you think?
So, I mean, I think it's great. I think that there are, you know, as teams are thinking about ways to, you know, get the most out of the team dynamics, this is a great place to start. I don't know how conscious you can make all this, but, you know, to the extent that you're just looking at team behaviors as ways to get a sense of if people are working together well or if there's tension within a group, tracking something like touch can be informative in that domain. I mean, you know, you don't want to throw away any of the other stuff that you would use for understanding team dynamics, like, you know, coaches have direct contact with players and teammates talk to each other. But to the extent that you're, you know, you're away from that kind of information, looking at touch can be a way to get into, you know, some of the internal workings of a team and its relationships.
In addition to there being something natural inside us that is drawn to touch, is there something that may lead to motivation to be more successful? Because, hey, I'm going to get, if I make this shot, I'm going to have my teammates are going to admire me, but they're also going to want to hug me, and I'm going to feel like, yeah, we are more together. We're not just guys on a roster together. We're actually feeling this and winning this way together.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, you can imagine the modern sports where players move around a lot more, trades happen, you know, players sit out some days. There could be a increasing tendency to feel disconnected from your teammates. And in a game like basketball, which relies on, you know, highly connected, synergistic individual players working together in defensive and offensive schemes, implementing behaviors that foster togetherness, foster closeness, foster communication, can really bridge that divide and prevent some of the atrophy of teamwork that could happen over the course of an 82-game schedule.
Here's the chicken and egg question for you. Is a winning team more likely to exchange high fives because things are going well for them, or do you think that having that togetherness could then lead to victories, which I think is what the Suns are sort of positing on this?
I think the analogy with, you know, home versus away advantage is relevant here, right? So a team that's, you know, just as good as it is will play better at home than on the road because of the support of the fans. And this is the same thing. It doesn't increase your ability to touch more, right? A team will have a certain level of ability regardless of how much they're together or not. But the behaviors that foster cooperation and build trust are likely to allow players to perform better together and more in unison.
Now, we do high fives around the office sometimes. If we do a good story or we're just happy to see somebody, do you do that around the office? Do you notice that's a bonding mechanism?
I think so. I mean, you know, with students, I try to shake their hands. With graduate students, you know, reassuring, pat on the back, high fives if we're doing really well, fist bumps, anything like that to, you know, create an atmosphere of trust and connection. There's no reason that the same mechanisms can't be in play in context outside of sports. Now, the reason it works best in sports context is because normatively it's totally okay to touch in that way. In other contexts, you're dealing with some norms and the possibility that other people can be uncomfortable with too much touch. So you have to be a little cagier out in the real world outside of sports. But the mechanism should be the same.
Yale assistant professor Michael Krauss, he and his colleagues looked up research, the impact of high fives and fist bumps on winning in the NBA.
High five!
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.